As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
I had a lot of friends in those buildings. Starfleet was able to destroy most of the Breen attack force, but by then, most of the damage had been done.
You must give the enemy credit to launch an attack on Starfleet headquarters. Even my people never attempted that. We've learned one thing about the Breen today, Captain. They're a race of warriors.
That's about all we know.
Welcome, everyone, to a book club. Yes, a book club episode of Positively Trek. We haven't had one in a while, and that's, like, everybody's fault that's associated with the show. In some way or another, we've had different reasons. We've had to delay and take a pause in our reading schedule, but we're back on it. We're back on top of it. This is the book club where we're going to cover the book from 2004, Tales of the Dominion War. And I'm excited about this. I'm Bruce Gibson with Dan Gunther. Dan, let's talk books. It's been forever.
I'm so excited. It feels like I read this book like a month and a half ago. Actually, that's probably about right. And we haven't been covering the books. We've put that on pause, and I'm so excited to talk about this book in particular.
Well, I'm excited about it too, because I didn't choose it and you didn't choose it. So back at Star Trek Mission Chicago, I did a book panel, and Jesse Earle, aka Jesse Gender, was on the panel with me, and she said to me afterwards, I want to come on a book club episode. I'm like, all right, pick a book. And it's this book. Jesse, you picked Tales of the Dominion War. Why did you pick that book?
Hi, listeners. Hi, everybody. I actually picked this one because I actually have never read it. Because back when I first got this book, because I've been collecting books since I was like 10, 11. I've been collecting Trek books. And this one was always on my shelf, but I hadn't seen the Deep Space Nine yet at that point. I'd only seen like TNG. So I got it. And it's like, it's Star Trek, but I don't know what this is. What is the Dominion War? And I was so confused. So I've had this book since like my early days of loving Trek and then never actually read it. I've thumbed through it and read like a story here or there since then. But I've just like, now I have an excuse to actually read it with everybody. And I was very excited to do it. So that's why I picked it. Cause it's one that like, I'm always like, oh yeah, I need an excuse to read it.
Yeah. Well, that's why we do this podcast, excuse to read books we haven't read excuse to reread books, which surprises me because I thought this was a favorite book of yours, but you hadn't read it before.
It's a favorite book of mine because of that reason. And also because I've like read certain stories of it that I did like. Like I do remember some of them because I did sort of pick them up and like the ones that were relating to characters that I knew, like Spock, for example, that appears in this. And then also Loxana Troi, because I knew them from like TNG and their appearances then when I was a kid. So I always loved those stories. But then I would get to like TOS stuff or things like that. And I'd be like, I don't know who are these people? What's happening? Okay, sure.
Yeah, because this is a mix of short stories that take place during the Dominion War that we didn't see on TV. Mm-hmm. Well, and there's some things that we did see on TV there in the book. But before we get into it, Jesse, could you give rundown of who you are to those people who have no idea who you are, which is surprising to me because I feel like everybody in Star Trek knows who you are.
No, most definitely not. But yeah, no, I'm just a dork making videos on the internet is how I initially sell myself. But for those of you who haven't heard of me, my name is Jesse Ginger. I make YouTube videos, mainly talking about political and social and LGBTQ and sometimes specifically transgender issues within pop culture and geekdom, with a focus hugely on Star Trek. So a lot of my videos will talk, like, take an episode of Star Trek and then sort of extrapolate it out into talking about, like, present day issues and things that we're talking about today, because science fiction and Star Trek has always been about that, always been about talking about issues of today rather than just tomorrow. And so the biggest video that you all have probably seen on my channel, if you've heard of me, is the Sex and Star Trek series, where I made a 5.5-hour video on Sex and Star Trek: The Next Generation and how it's displayed and thought of. So it's a fun job to have, but it's a really, really weird one to have. So I enjoy it, and people seem to enjoy it. So I'm continuing to do it. So that's me.
Awesome. Well, of course, we're so thrilled to have you on the show. We've had you on the show before for just kind of a regular episode, but first time doing the book club. So that's exciting.
Which is hilarious because, like, I'm a huge book fan. Like, Star Trek books are actually my favorite part of Trek. So I'm like, have me on, please.
Now, why is that? Why are the books your favorite thing of Trek? Because that's how I am, too. It's what kind of sold me more on Trek and how I became a bigger fan.
Two reasons. The first reason was I got into Trek right towards the end of, like, the Rick Berman era. Like, I started watching Star Trek week to week on Star Trek Enterprise Season 3. So I only had 2 years of, like, getting to watch Star Trek as it was on the air. And then after that, I would discover it in reruns and stuff. But the only, like, Trek that I had to look forward to, like, it's, like, a new thing coming out for a very long time, was the Star Trek books. Mm-hmm. And also my parents are divorced, so they would meet whenever they would, like, trade me off between their houses to, like, see them. They would meet at a bookstore, and I would always go to the book section and just, like, read all the Star Trek books that were in there in the Barnes & Noble or whatever. Or Borders, actually, if anyone remembers that. So, yeah, no, that's one element of it. That was just part of my Trek experience. And then I just think the books just, like, are more inventive with the Trek universe. Not that, like, the Trek shows themselves aren't, but, like, the books aren't limited by, like, whether they can get the actor to come in or the big budget of this scene. They can, like, do really weird and out there and crazy things, especially in now that I know it's ended. As a kid, I really just loved the, like, post-Nemesis timeline books that recently finished up with Coda. So, yeah, I just, for all of those reasons, I just love the books. I think they're some of the best parts.
I love to hear you say that. I actually just recently, a coworker who's just getting into Star Trek was talking to me, and all of those, like, questions that people have when they're first getting into Star Trek, they're like, how do you feel about the fact that Star Trek seems to be a military dictatorship and blah, blah, blah? And I'm like, oh, you've just seen episodes. You need to read the books. Like, they're doing the world building there that make this universe make a bit more sense.
I always still argue to this day, like, anyone who is, like, a Trekkie, I'm like, if you really want Star Trek, read anything by Una McCarthy.
Yes.
That's where the real Trek begins.
Star Trek written by a doctor of sociology is how Una writes Star Trek, right? So, yeah, that's so good.
Mm-hmm. Literally any book that has her name on it, I'm like, all right, I'm already in for it. It's my favorite book already.
Yeah, she does some incredible books. And I mean, there's so many good books out there, and there's some stinkers, especially in the early days. But, you know, that's the thing when new Star Trek TV shows were coming on. They're so different. They don't fit the norm, you know, when Discovery, that type of serialized, where everything else was episodic, it was something different. But at the same time, to me, it kind of felt like a novel. So I feel like reading the novels and, like you said, doing stranger types of things in the novels, things that are different that we're not used to seeing on screen, made it maybe even easier for me to accept something different on screen. Do you think that was the case maybe for you too?
I think so, yeah. I mean, like, novels can get weird, and I always liked weird, and I always like experimenting with the format and things like that. And even, like, there's a direct lineage from the books to the current crop of shows with, like, Kirsten Beyer being on Discovery, and I think she came out in season one and then became a producer at Picard in that series and sort of been throughout all the shows in a lot of different ways. So, yeah, there's, like, a direct lineage there, and I think that really helped. But even, like, the older books that you were talking about, that, like, are, like, some stinkers, I think they're fun.
Yeah.
like even books that are bad, I've always made the argument I would rather a weird and bad story than one that's just sort of like, yeah, that's fine. It's like my problem with like big budget movies a lot of the time nowadays, where it's just like, yeah, that was fine. And honestly, I'm just kind of bored. I'd rather like a movie just swing big and totally miss, or a book or anything like that, rather than it just being like, yeah, that was okay.
Yeah.
I think it's just way more interesting.
Taking some risks rather than, you know, oh, it tested well with audiences, you know.
Exactly. That's why I always argue with Picard season 2, not to get off on this tangent, but like, I don't like Picard season 2. It's probably my least favorite of definitely the modern shows. But that being said, I still appreciate season 2 because it was taking a risk and doing something different, rather than like it just had been like, yeah, that was a fine season of a show. Like, I have feelings about Picard season 2, and I'd rather have feelings about something rather than it just be like, yeah, that came out and existed.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, it seems that season 2, it's either people love it or, well, I don't want to say hate it, but yeah.
I know some people that do hate it, even people that generally like other stuff.
Right. Well, okay, let's get to this book, because there's so many Trek authors that are well known that participate in writing stories in this book. But Dan, I wanted to ask you, you've read this book prior to us rereading it for this episode, right?
I actually hadn't. This was my first time reading it. This is one that for whatever reason I never acquired. It's never been on my shelf. And which is crazy because it's right up my alley, right? Like, I sing the praises of Deep Space Nine. I love that show so much. I love all of Star Trek, but I love Deep Space Nine. So it kind of shocked me that I'd never read this one, even though I see it referenced all the time in other novels by other stories that these many authors have written. But yeah, this was my first time reading it.
Wow. Okay. I just assumed that you probably read, I guess because when I read it, when it came out, I just assume, oh, well, Dan probably did too. I don't know why I think that way, but yeah, I got it when it came out in 2004. I read it, or, you know, probably that year or around that time. But, yeah, then I reread it like whatever, June or whenever we were talking about doing this episode. And then I kind of skimmed through it again recently, and it helps to reread it again, but I'm still probably going to forget parts, and you guys will probably remind me of certain
things. I'll be
in
the same spot too, because yeah, it's been a couple of weeks since I read it, so I'll be like, parts that hopefully I forgot, you'll remember, and vice versa.
Yeah, hopefully we can all patch each other's memories here.
Exactly, because it's not this one single story, right? So it's probably easier to remember, because I think there's, what, 12 in here? There's 12 different short stories.
Yeah,
So, you know, we're not going to go through each one at a time, because I can tell you we could spend 5-10 minutes on each one. This show will go on forever, but I do want to touch on all of them. But, you know, my first question though, and I'm not going to point to either one of you, so I'll let whoever wants to go first on this, because I'm putting you on the spot, but did you have a favorite story that really stands out?
Ooh, I'm going to jump in, and it's probably the answer that a lot of people have, because it really stuck out on this, is 11 Hours Out by Dave Gallanter. That's the Breen attack on Earth, and Picard is there separated from the Enterprise, kind of having to coordinate the planetary defense and stuff. For a number of reasons, A, it's got a lot of action, it's got a lot of stakes, and B, I mean, Dave Gallanter, having fairly recently lost him, and him being someone who I've developed a personal relationship with over the years. I just, to kind of read this and realize, oh, there's another story by him that I haven't read yet, just made reading that extra special to me. So for a number of reasons, that one just immediately kind of floats to the top in my mind.
That's really sweet. And yeah, that was a really good one. That one would be up there. There are, for me, I think it's kind of tied between two. One is Twilight's Wrath, which is David Mack's one, which is actually the one that features the character of Shinzon. Mostly because Star Trek Nemesis is my least favorite Star Trek movie, but it's the one that I had so much, like, the idea of the Remans is so fascinating. Like, this oppressed race that, like, are also a further offshoot of Vulcans. And like the character of Shinzon was so misused, but I think has an interesting place. And so actually getting a story with him within the Dominion War and how he used that to get to power, I think is actually a really, really cool storyline to see that you normally wouldn't get to see in Trek. So I am glad that that one exists. And then the other one that I really loved was it was called The Ceremony of Innocence is Drowned, which is the Loxana Troi one, because it Loxana Troi, another, I guess I just appreciate the underappreciated characters, which is just Loxana Troi is always underappreciated. And I love this storyline because it like showed her like kind of fierce fire that sort of gets ignited during the Dominion War, and also some of the horrors that happened to Beta Zed, which only get sort of referenced within Deep Space Nine and never really actually shown, and sort of just some of the things that happens there. So I think those two are probably my favorite of this one.
Yeah, and that one's by Keith R.A. DeCandido, who's also the editor of the book of short stories. I did like the one with Shinzon because, like you said, it, even though Nemesis isn't necessarily one of my favorite movies, I like getting the backstory on him. It's kind of like a prequel to that movie. Mm-hmm. It really would have helped that movie even more to see that story play out maybe at the beginning. I mean, they wouldn't have time or whatever to do it. But I did enjoy seeing him, that rise to power and how he got the device mm-hmm. for that ship and everything. And it was all related to, you know, how he got dragged in with the Remans into this war and took advantage of it. And so that was, I really did enjoy that story too.
It really helps Nemesis quite a bit because, like, there are many problems I have with that movie, but one of my major problems, or two of my major problems with that film is, one, it's like you learn that the Remans are this oppressed species that are like working around the mines, and then for some reason they suddenly have the most powerful ship in all of Star Trek up until that point. Mm-hmm. It's like, how and why? that has like a doomsday weapon. I was like, it's just sort of out of nowhere, and there's no explanation given in the film. So that's a problem that this story solves. And then also just like it's a problem that I have with a lot of like big budget movies sometimes where they sort of create bad guys who are like revolutionaries fighting for oppressed causes. And then they make them turn out to be the villains of the piece because they're not doing it in the right way or using violence. And yes, we could have an argument about like whether or not violence is justified in certain situations. But like it usually movies and Nemesis is a problem with this where it just sort of makes them out to be like, Bwahaha, I'm evil because I'm evil, instead of like actually listening to the like justifiable arguments that they would have. Like Remans would have a correct argument to be like, yeah, the Romulans treated us like crap and we have an understandable resentment against them. But the movie never really brings it up. It just sort of like, and now I'm going to sexually assault Deanna Troi because I'm evil and now I want to have like a hissy fit and go after Earth. Like it just, that's sort of the major problem with Nemesis, that this storyline this book, like at least does its best to try to fix a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, brings me to something that these novels and these short stories do a lot of. Like they do a lot of the grunt work behind the scenes to make some things that really don't make a lot of sense at least kind of make a little sense, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I like the stories too, because it has that opportunity to do those things, but it also shows us where these different ships, crews, and characters were during the Dominion War, because we always just got it on Deep Space Nine and we didn't see what was going on elsewhere in the galaxy. So we play off really well in this, because each story that follows seems to build chronologically during the war, you know, the Breen attack on Earth, and then there's some stories that play off of that until we get to the final episode of Deep Space Nine of What You Leave Behind, and that plays into this too. I like how that was edited together with these stories.
Yeah, that was really cool. I didn't even realize that when I was reading it. Like, you get the Breen attack in that one storyline, and then it's referenced and brought up in subsequent stories. And I was like, oh, that's really cool that it has that sort of internal continuity within there. Like, that's just a clever little conceit that they had in this that you don't see in anthology books like this often.
I also really want to call out the story A Song Well Sung by Robert Greenberger. Bruce, you and I have fairly recently in the last couple of years done all of the IKS Gorkon Star Trek Klingon novels. And we always get the reference to that story of how Clegg lost his arm and how he single-handedly fought off all these gems. And just to see that story play out, that one was so much fun. Like, you know, as far as fun as a story of a one-armed Klingon beating the crap out of a whole bunch of people could be, you know, and it's Star Trek. That can be a lot of fun, so...
That story was really cool. I haven't read the Gorkon books, but I know of them. And so I was like, oh, cool, I get to read a Gorkon story. I didn't realize it was like actually directly referencing like a backstory that they had for it.
Yeah, we get, because they're all part of the post Nemesis continuity a time to like that era of books, the inciting incidents are all like, you know, oh, this happened during the Dominion War. So they kind of get to go back and actually tell that story now.
Oh, that's so cool. I didn't realize that. Cause it was a great story. It was like a cool thing to see, like what the Klingon, cause we got to see some of the Klingon Empire in Deep Space Nine, but it was mostly like through Martok or Worf and also Gowron a little bit. It was all like very like top level Klingon Empire stuff for the most part. And so this was the story is like, what was just a one-off like Klingon captain doing during this time and trying to survive? And it was just sort of like the stuck on the planet. I'm facing off against like however many Jem'Hadar and it's just one Klingon and just taking them down piece by piece was just really cool.
Yes. Yes. I did enjoy that too. I see. Now I'm getting more excited because now it's like, oh yeah, I remember that. Oh yeah, that too. And all that. Mm-hmm. And one of the ones that I really liked, I don't know if it's my favorite, but I like Mirror Eyes because it's the a Romulan undercover agent on Deep Space Nine. And I like her being on Deep Space Nine. So it kind of felt like a Deep Space Nine episode because it had Sisko and, of course, Dr. Bashir and such. But it also had Beverly Crusher there helping out. And this was written by Heather Jarman and Jeffrey Lang. But I loved it was from her perspective of trying to sneak around and trying to do her mission, but also, you know, they're wanting to test her because all these Vulcans have been infected with some virus or something. And they're just like, you know, oh, we want to test your blood too. Oh, you don't seem to be dying from this, but you're a Vulcan too. And she's like, oh no, they're going to find out I'm a Romulan. And I just kind of liked how that played out. The one thing though I didn't like is they called Dr. McCoy, or I should say Admiral McCoy, and I don't really felt like that was necessary. I just felt like they were just, oh, we got to put all the doctors in here because we have an EMH, and we also then, oh, we're using Phlox something that flocks, right? Right.
It did feel like the whole concept of the story came from, like, let's try and find a Dominion War story that could, like, reference all the doctors. And so every single doctor gets brought in, which, like, is a cool idea. But then it ultimately, I think, wasn't as interesting as the actual just like, as you say, the point of view of the storyline. Because it's not just from that character's point of view. It's like we actually get her like secret logs, like diary logs that she's making, which I thought was a really cool like way to see it. Because there's like, it wasn't even the logs that she was making for the station or the logs that she was making for the Tal Shiar. It was just like her ones that she was like keeping hidden from everybody. They're like logs throughout the story was just so like I just like their perspective because they were like, this gets found out, I could be killed. But also I'm just so frustrated because like my identity doesn't feel like my own. And then on top of that, like I'm just pissed off because my job seems so pointless because like everyone knows what's going on at Deep Space Nine because it's the middle of a war. So like anything that happens here is fairly public. And so I loved that like constant conflict that the character had in the story. And so it was just sort of much more like, I feel like the story was pitched as like a, let's get all the doctors involved. But then when they started writing it, they ultimately had a much more interesting character, but they still sort of like had to go with that, like get all the doctors in here.
Yeah. There's so much that I like about that story. That's one that when I revisit it, I keep finding more that I love about it. Mm-hmm. And one of the big things too, is it's so hard to write a story that takes place on Deep Space Nine during any of this time period, because you need to find a place to put it that makes sense when you pretty much see everything that's happening day to day. And I thought it was brilliant that if you notice Captain Sisko is not in command of the station, Colonel Kira is. That's because this is between the end of season 6 and the beginning of season 7. You've got like 2 or 3 months there to kind of play with. So the Enterprise visited and there was a big, huge pandemic involving Vulcans. Yeah. Okay, cool. You know, that it would be weird to think that that happened between, you know, Chimera and Field of Fire in season 7 or something, but it works there. Mm. And it's just so well crafted and makes such good use of that setting in that time period. I love it.
No, it was very, very clever. Like, yeah, that was also an excellent story.
I like Field Expediency by Dayton Ward and Kevin Dillmore too, because even if you don't read the SEC novels, the Starfleet Corps of Engineer novels, it still plays well. You don't need to have read any of those novels. They were a bunch of e-books back in the day, and they were republished as short stories in different printed publications. But you have the USS Da Vinci and these characters of Duffy and Stevens, and they're fighting the Breen forces. And I liked how these are engineers that, what was it, some device or something they had to get out of the crashed ship, and you know, because they didn't want the Breen to get this, you know, device and this information or whatever on there. And I think it was Duffy, which one? No, Stevens gets hurt, or I can't remember which one. I think it was Stevens.
Yeah. That's correct.
And then you have like these other officers, Starfleet officers there to help. I don't know. I just, that one was kind of fun for me. I mean, because it wasn't fun just like, oh, fun, ha, ha, ha. No, it's war, right? I mean, they're dealing with war and shooting off these Breen and worrying about being attacked, worrying about dying, but they have to get this information out. They can't get to the ship, so they have to survive. I thought that was an interesting book. And that, yeah, by Dayton Ward and Kevin Dillmore. So, yeah, that was a good one for me.
That was a fun one to showcase what people who aren't soldiers are doing during this, and the uses they're being put to during this war effort and stuff. I thought that was fascinating, and the little kind of turns the story took with regards to, you know, Captain Gold kind of saying, you know, look after my engineers, and the intelligence operative being like, yeah, no, we got them kind of thing. It's interesting, the kind of interplay there.
It felt like a little bit of like very Lower Decksian in a kind of a way. It, not necessarily in them being like Lower Decks in terms of their rank or anything like that, but in terms of their necessity during the war and still like actually being of use and like needing to get this like Breen MacGuffin that they're trying to bring back.
Yes. Any other standouts that you can think of that stand out to you? I mean, we got the first story, What Dreams May Come by Michael Jan Friedman. And I enjoyed that because that had the Vorta in it. Mm-hmm. And it had this character, Draz, who was the servant, and telling the story of, oh, you know, I had this dream that I was off planet and I could do these things. And he's like, oh, you're a servant. You could never do these things. But oh, no, there's a secret identity in Draz.
Yep, it was that was so great. I mean, I saw it coming before like it actually got revealed, and I was like, oh, Vorta, you're in for some pain. But it was like, it was one of those like kind of, it felt like one of those like Shakespearean tragedy sort of things where you just have like the very like lord ruler sort of sitting on his throne being like, I'm just sitting here enjoying myself without realizing the pride cometh before the fall, as they say. So I thought that was a really cool, like, cute little story to start off with.
Yeah, I enjoyed the kind of ratcheting up of tension because it's from the Vorta's perspective. It had kind of an almost Telltale Heart feel to it, where that slow dawning of realization of what's happening and how much trouble he's actually in. I enjoyed that aspect of it for sure. That was fun.
Mm-hmm. It also kind of showed us how the Vorta sort of disregarded first contact rules. Like, in the Federation would be like, we need to protect these planets. We can like can't go there. The Vorta's like, huh, yeah, these backwater planets, we'll just set up, make ourselves gods for a while. And yeah, they'll figure it out eventually, but by that point, we'll already be too ingrained and we'll have already gotten what we needed from them from the war. So just showcase a different philosophy around this time that the Dominion was willing to use in order to get what they wanted, the resources they needed from the war, which was an interesting sort of like background element.
You know, Michael Jan Friedman is also known for writing a bunch of the Stargazer novels. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I didn't say at the beginning of this episode, and it's too late to say it now, but we are getting into spoilers here.
Yes.
But anybody who listens to our shows know that we dive right into these. But the secret agent is revealed to be Ben Zoma, who was security chief on the Stargazer in Michael Jan Friedman's novels. And I mean, I have only read maybe one or two of those. So, I mean, I'm not that familiar with them, but I did recognize the character's name when I got to the end of this story. But a lot of people wouldn't. But it is kind of revealed that he is working with Jean-Luc Picard because he does contact him. So again, I love the play off of novels. You know, they just don't play off of what you see on screen, but they play off of other novels that have been out there and just add more and more to it.
Yeah, this is what I miss about, like, and we're still getting that with some of the books that are coming out now that are in the sort of the new timeline, sort of post like Picard timeline, where they do kind of interconnect a little bit. But I do miss that this era of like Star Trek novels where you just had like oh, like this author writes like this series of novels a lot of the time, and this author writes this series, like Peter David writes the New Frontier novels or whatever, and then those characters suddenly pop up every once in a while in other things and get referenced. So that, this book sort of was like a nice little way for those to all weave through. But also the book does a good job where, like, if you don't know those things, it still works as its own, like, singular story.
Yeah, it's a nice little treat if you're aware of those things. It rewards the longtime readers while not alienating the newcomers, right? So
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what I tell people all the time. Even if you don't read other Star Trek novels, I mean, they catch you up, or you don't even need to read those novels to know the backstory when you're picking up another novel. The story is good enough as it is. And speaking of these little treats, Night of the Vulture by Greg Cox, the next one in this book, does that thing too, because wasn't it the Q Continuum novels, Dan, that we read that uses the Beta 12A entity?
Yeah, the little spinning ball of light that feeds on hatred and racial prejudice and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun because it was nice to see a little TOS reference, and also getting to see things from its point of view too, which is kind of interesting. I loved that. And also like seeing how it was like very, very hungry during the middle of the Dominion War, or very like getting to build up all the resentments of a war. Showcases like, oh, this is a feeding time, I guess is the best way to put it.
I was thinking during that story that like Star Trek does this thing where it does outlandish, weird, alien, sci-fi, crazy stuff until it's like, oh no, we need to focus on a real world allegory, like a war. And it's like all of that stuff kind of just pauses for a while we do, you know, war allegories and stories about soldiers and that kind of thing. But this is the Star Trek universe. All of that stuff is still out there. And how does that respond to, you know, a quadrant spanning conflict where there's these vast armies facing off? And so, yeah, a creature that feeds on hatred and fighting, what would their feeding grounds look like during this conflict, and what might that result in? I really liked that. I thought that was great.
And it died, right? At the end?
Or it gets stuck, doesn't it?
Or I think stuck
it
just gets or something, yeah.
The black hole or something, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's like some sort of like spatial phenomenon, a black hole or something like that, that it feeds for too long because it gets so sucked into like pitting all these people against each other that eventually it does sort of just stay too long, and then the ship gets caught, and I think in the gravity well or whatever, and now it can't escape for forever. And whether or not it starves to death or not, we don't know, but it's sort of hinted at that it's stuck there for the rest of the time.
Yeah, and I like how it's referred to, it's just an asterisk with parentheses around, and we've seen that used in other Greg Cox books about this entity, so that was familiar to me to see that too. I'll never look in an asterisk the same way again.
It's gonna an asterisk can make you feel racial resentments, I guess. Right. dang asterisks.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
This episode of Positively Trek is brought to you by our wonderful supporters on Patreon, including our Constitution class supporters, Jim Stoffel, Joyce Marin, Carl Morris, Dave Garcia, Rick Young, Paul D. Kinnear, Jesse Earl, and Justin Ozer. Thank you all so much for your support of Positively Trek. If you would like to become a patron of the show, go to patreon.com/positivelytrek. You can get early access to episodes, exclusive content, shoutouts, associate producer credits, and more. Once again, that's patreon.com/positivelytrek. Thank you all once again. And now let's get back to the show. Well, you know, before we get to some of these other stories in here, I want to mention this other thing. So at the beginning of each story, it kind of gave you a little brief history of where the story takes place or what events happen before this story. And then after that, it would give you like a little bio about the author. Mm. And I have to admit, I did read the, you know, the little history thing at the beginning saying it up, but I didn't read about the authors because I know all these authors, so I didn't feel like I needed to, but I was just curious if any of you read those.
I did. I do remember. I definitely did read them just because I don't know. I have this weird thing in my brain where I'm like, oh, the author put some work into writing this thing. I have to honor them, you know, because they'll totally know if I read it or not. But yeah, it's one of those things that like sometimes I'm like, oh, that's interesting, that's cool, and then other times, and I hate to say it, where I'm like, oh, I just read that and I did not retain any of that. Sorry Greg Cox, love ya.
That was pretty much my feeling on it too, because yeah, I don't remember any of them, to be quite frank, because I do vaguely know most of these authors. So I was like, oh yeah, that's that author that does this thing. It was nice to sort of touch upon, like, some of them would say like, oh, this author writes like these novels or these types of books that sort of like give a little prelude of what characters might be in the story. But other than that, yeah, I didn't really remember too much.
Yeah, I didn't read them. I kind of know what you say, Dan. It's like I feel like I should, you know, because it's there. I mean, that's why I have the book, is to read the whole thing. But at the same time, I'm like, why should I read this right now? Because I already know who these people are and what they've written. I mean, I glanced at them, but I just didn't sit there and just read it word for word. So I was just curious if any of you had done that or not.
So what we're saying is, if any of those authors are listening right now, we hate you. David Mack or Dayton Ward or anybody, Peter David's listening, we hate you. That's the long and short of it.
We hate you until we read your bio, and then we appreciate you. Of course not. Okay, so then we have another story in here where involves the Romulan Senate, and mm-hmm. they're trying to decide if they want to ally with the Federation or the Klingon Empire and fighting the Dominion. And Spock is involved. And Jesse, you mentioned earlier in this episode that you remembered Spock was in this book.
Yes, and so to be fair, I actually remember reading that story when I was a kid because it was like, oh, I know Spock and Unification and all that stuff, because I'd seen Unification at that point. So I remember reading the story and enjoying it. I will say, reading it now, it honestly didn't work as well for me. Mm. I think it was probably one of my least favorite ones, which is sad because it feels like it should be one of my favorite ones, because I do love like political machination stories, and I always love like the idea of exploring Spock on Romulus more. Whenever he's on there, I'm sort of like interested. But yeah, for some reason, the story, and maybe you'll disagree, but like Spock felt a little bit out of character in this story for me. Like, he felt a little bit more like emotional and angry at certain points, and sort of dismissive of like other Romulan characters at certain points, that in a way that like didn't really ring true to me as well as I think his character normally would. And that's just me, but maybe I'll disagree. But yeah, it just his characterization just didn't really ring completely true.
Yeah, I've got to agree. I feel like for me, this was probably the weakest story in the book for mm-hmm. me. Just as far as feeling like it was very divorced from everything else that was happening in the war. And then, as you say, Spock just, you know, it's a different Spock than what we're used to. And part of that for me is I've not read, I don't think, any of the Josepha Sherman and Susan Schwartz Spock novels, of which there are quite a few by this point, a number of trilogies, I think, that they've done dealing with Spock and his reunification efforts and other points in his life and stuff. And I'm wondering if this story might be much more appreciated had I read some of those stories and could kind of see like, oh, this is where the authors are getting this from and kind of fitting it in. But yeah, for me, I felt a little bit too cast adrift by the story to find kind of those anchor points where I could connect to it. I was not really engaged by the material on a number of levels.
Yeah, and there was also like at the end of the story, there was this sort of, so part of the story involves, and I'm trying to remember because it's been a hot minute, but this emperor was old at the time, and this is like right before, why am I blanking on it? The very famous, it's a fake episode.
In the pale moonlight.
Thank you so much. It's right before that. And so it's like Spock trying to sort of get people involved in the war, and the Romulans sort of arguing about that, about whether or not they should join or not, because they're not idiots. They know the Dominion is somewhat like not completely telling the truth, and they're always distrustworthy, just distrusting people in general. Anyways, the Romulan Emperor gets supposedly murdered, and the story kind of ends up with like Spock kind of confronting the Praetor at the time. And like having this like logical argument about the display of bodies, and it's an interesting sort of like argument, but it ultimately felt like it wasn't really like going anywhere that felt pertinent to like the entering of the war. You know what I mean? It just sort of felt like this sort of like him tricking this guy to get this other dude to be there, and it was just like it was a very convoluted story that like it just didn't really felt like it. You know, I like convoluted stories, but it just didn't really feel like it had much of a point. That really felt like it sort of fit this idea of like, should we join the war or not? Which seemed like that would be the sort of interesting ethical conundrum here.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I hadn't thought about it too much. It takes place, of course, during the Dominion War. It's set up because they're thinking, should they join in it? But yeah, the story doesn't really focus on the war. It's more about this emperor and this guy kind of, you know, leading to the murder or whatever and why he's doing what he's doing. I found the Romulan storyline a bit interesting for me, so I did enjoy that piece. And just following Spock trying to figure that out. I don't know. Yeah, I think, Dane, like you said, this is a different time for Spock, so maybe that's why Spock might feel a little different than what we're used to. But it still worked for me. It wasn't one of my favorites, but I still enjoyed the whole Romulan aspect of it. I'm starting to realize that I really like the Romulan stuff. Like, I'm not really big into Romulans, but for some reason I was really liking them in this book.
I think my problem is just, like, I think I'd be really interested in Romulan politics stories. Like, those books may be something I would love to pick up, because I haven't read them either, but I have them. But, like, it's something that I would like to be interested in. I just think when this is a short story, the story that this one was trying to tell was just a little bit overcomplicated and a little bit convoluted and not necessarily focused enough on what it wanted to say. And so when you have a short story, you kind of want to be a little bit more focused than, let's say, a novel would be, where you can kind of have these sort of like big, long tangents and explorations.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I just think that this story just didn't feel focused enough and ultimately just sort of left me feeling, I think, Dan, you said a little bit adrift.
Yeah.
While rating it. So.
And I think I remember looking up a number of the characters and events in the story and realizing that they link quite heavily to a lot of the storylines in some of those other novels that
I could get that.
Yeah. I just have no experience with them. So it's kind of like, ooh, this character came in and said this. Whoa. And it's, to me, who has never met this character before, it just fell flat kind of thing. So,
Yeah. Well, that story, I don't think we mentioned it, is called Blood Sacrifice. So if anybody's picking up the book, still read it, you know?
Yeah, no, it's definitely interesting. It's like, it's not like it's one of those like trash don't read it at all. It's not horrible, but it was just not my favorite.
Yeah. Okay, so we've touched on some of the other stories that follow it, and then we get to 11 Hours Out, Dan, which you mentioned earlier was one of your favorites, and we didn't talk a whole lot about it, but the Breen attack on Earth to me, having this like halfway or a little past halfway in the collection of stories really worked for me, because it felt like all these stories that we were getting are taking different places during the Dominion War. And then this is this big event that happens that kind of sets up a lot of the stories that follow. It's the whole Breen attack and how the Breen are involved. And it just, this really felt like a tragic war story to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It really, to me, sets up the, like, the stories before this and the stories after it. So it really works as a linchpin for the collection, I think.
Yeah. And I also really think that, like, it kind of sold like Earth getting scarred in the war, because other than the two-parter in Deep Space Nine that is before the war itself, where they go back home and sort of like the fear that a lot of people are feeling on Earth leading from the shapeshifters leading to like a military state almost, that's the only really time you get a sense of like Earth really feeling the ramifications of the war. And so I, because even in season 7, you get Sisko on Earth and it seems all pretty fine. I mean, he's allowed, like, the war's going on, he's allowed to take 2 months off to go work in work at Sisko's for a while. The war never really seems to hit home on Earth in a way that this novel, or this story, I should say, lets you feel. And I like that. I like that, like, Earth, like, felt some of the scars of the Dominion War in a way that they was sort of allowed to not be in the show.
And I have to say, as someone who's not a citizen of the United States, I can't, of course, know exactly what this was like and stuff. But, you know, I had parents who were vacationing in the U.S. on 9/11, and a lot of what they were saying that the people around them seemed to be experiencing and that, I saw a lot of that in this story. And I'm wondering if that was something that either of you picked up on as well, that there was this, you know, idea of this complacency and all of a sudden this can't happen here kind of thing going on, which I thought worked really well in the utopia of Earth in the 24th century.
Yeah, 100%. No, it definitely has a post 9/11 or a 9/11 attack sort of feel to it, most certainly. And also the sort of like collective pain of it that you get from it, that like came out of that time, that was sadly used for, unfortunately, very patriotic and nationalistic ends that were not so great at the time. But the sense of collective pain and community that you get a sense of towards the end of that story with Picard sort of wanting to protect the younger Starfleet ensign, or was it, or young Starfleet ensign, that was part of like his extended family, from this sort of stuff, and realized that he really can't. I think like that element of it was sort of interesting.
Yeah, that whole thing about, oh, they can't, you know, attack Earth, we're well protected, it won't happen here, and it does. That even plays off in the next story called Safe Harbors by Howard Weinstein, where Admiral McCoy and Captain Scott, Montgomery Scott, they've left Earth, they're on the ship, and they get the news of this. And even then, it's like, oh, that couldn't happen. Earth's fine. It wouldn't happen there. So it even plays into that story. But now I'm just curious of your thoughts on Safe Harbors, because they're helping, you know, they get in touch with this another starship that has lost its captain, has these young officers on it because they were attacked by Breen and the captain's dead and everything. And so Scotty and McCoy are on this planet getting their ship repaired or whatever. And this is a planet that usually kind of just stays away from anything and they don't get involved. What did you think of this story?
This was probably my second least favorite one, just because it felt, again, another unfocused one. And to be quite frank with you, since we did read this a while ago, this is the one that kind of slides off my brain a little bit the most, that I don't really remember much of it. Just, I remember reading it and being kind of like, okay, what's exactly going on? Like, I liked the idea of it coming off of the Breen attack of the last story. That was probably the most interesting part of it for me. The rest of it just kind of like just glanced off my head and it didn't really stick in there for at least a month or so later. So
yeah, this one might be my second least favorite as well. I did enjoy it. There were a number of things that I did kind of connect to in the story. One of them being McCoy and Scott kind of getting this news second, third hand of something that's going on, but not really getting a confirmation. I kind of liked that uncertainty there and putting myself in their place of how I'd feel if I found out that my home had been attacked or something had happened, but there's just, you know, is it still there? Is it not? That was interesting. I kind of almost wanted them to play with that a little bit more than they did. And then, of course, the other thing, this civilization that they've encountered who knows of the Federation but isn't allied with them, isn't a member, and they have this kind of neutrality going on where, you know, they're not picking sides. I kind of enjoyed that. I also felt like it had a little bit of Small Planet syndrome where I'm like, okay, we're seeing how this one guy feels about this and this other person, but like, what about the government? Like, what? It seemed kind of weird to me that we're only dealing with this like repair base and that's it. And they're setting policy, I guess, for the whole planet or something. But it seemed a little weird that way, but I liked some of the themes they were exploring there. Like, what does neutrality mean? And, you know, what does, I mean, who knows what good versus evil is and how you determine that. But in the Star Trek universe, we know the Federation generally the good guys, right? And, you know, how does a species that says they're neutral react to that and when given the evidence on either side and stuff? I don't know. It was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you just made me think of, with your first part of that, I mean, I agree with everything that you said, but like the first part of that was when 9/11 happened here, because I was very young at the time, my dad and my stepmom were actually in, I believe, France. They were in Europe, and I believe it was France. And they like had to deal with like being in another culture at that time. And I remember like one story they said was they were out for dinner and someone at like another table heard them talking and said, "Oh, are you American?" And they said, "Yes." And they sent them a bottle of wine. Oh, again, wow. Sort of that like that sort of like people being very understanding and empathetic of just like the sort of cultural trauma and national trauma that was for many people in the United States. And so that element would have been really interesting to sort of see, because they would have had to learn about it like through those secondhand ways. So it would have been an interesting sort of idea that this story didn't really explore. So you made me think about that.
It's interesting how we keep bringing up 9/11, and this book was only 5 years after that. Mm-hmm. You know? No, actually, three years after that.
I mean, it was around the same time. That would have been around the same time that like Enterprise tried to do that storyline with season 3.
Yeah,
the Zindi
arc. Yeah,
it just shows you again how current issues and things of the time influence the storytellings in Star Trek. Yeah. You know,
Star Trek is always about the today, not tomorrow. Like people, it's hopefully showing us. I mean, Star Trek is always about showing us how to do the issues of today, hopefully better than we are doing them today. Like a hopeful way to deal with what we're dealing with today. But it is always about today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, today we have another story we're going to talk about in here that we haven't discussed, and that's Stone Cold Truths by Peter David. And this is a play off of the New Frontiers stories that he puts together. And this is also, I'm probably going to guess, the shortest of these stories that are in here, because I remember it being a pretty quick read. Actually, a lot of his books flow very fast when I read them, but I think it was shorter than most of the others. So, Dan, you look excited to talk about this one.
I enjoyed this one. This was one that when I first started reading it, I was kind of going like, okay, what's going on here? And then as you read it, you kind of start to clue in that like, oh, okay, we've got an unreliable narrator, yada, yada, yada. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the conceit of this story that it's 150 years after the end of the war, Zach Kebron, who's a character from New Frontier, this large rock creature called a Brykar, you know, has a son who's learning about the Dominion War in school and has to, you know, ask Zach about it because he was there. And he tells the story of the Excalibur emerging from being out of time and showing up in the middle of the war and not knowing what's going on. And there's like repelling boarding parties going over to another ship, like broadsiding them like a pirate ship and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, it had like grappling hooks, I think, too, didn't it? At one point, right?
Yeah, yep. Grappling hooks and at that point, I'm going like, what the heck is this? Like, okay, Peter David's ridiculous, but this is just too... And then my brain goes, oh, wait, I see what's happening here. And it's about, you know, the glories of war and the stories we tell of war and what war actually is and how it's not something to be celebrated, which is, you know, all messaging I can absolutely get behind. So it's typical Peter David. It's a little bit on the nose. It's not particularly subtle, but you know, he just does not particularly subtle so darn good that I'm okay with it.
I've always said subtlety is like a thing to celebrate if you can do it well, and it can be the, but like subtlety is a tool and you don't need to be subtle mm-hmm. to tell a good story. So yeah, no, I always love Peter David because he's always wacky and weird. Like any Peter David story, you know you're in for something strange. And he never lets you down in that aspect. And this was definitely that. It was just a lot of fun.
And Zach is a Breikar, like you said, which is Rock Talk now in Prodigy is also mm-hmm. all that. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty cool too. Yeah, I kind of enjoyed this story. At first I was just like, okay, this is kind of a cute story in a way and kind of weird. But yeah, I like then the ending. He's teaching his son, you know, about war and whatever. And it's like, okay, that was good. It felt good to be the second to the last story, I think, because a lot of these were kind of heavy, where this one wasn't so much, you know, it just kind of lightened the mood until we got to the last one.
Yeah. And I also, it kind of reminds me again, if you keep on relating it to 9/11, it reminds me of at that time, a lot of my teachers, when 9/11 happened, they kept saying to me, like, oh, people are going to ask you when you're older, like, where were you on 9/11? Like, that's always the thing that they would used to say. And this is the story that is going to be like that. And yeah, it might possibly be the case that, you know, 20, 30 years from now, whether I have a kid or I have, you know, family members or something like that who are younger, ask me that. And yeah, that'll be what happens.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that that Peter David does that I think he does quite often is his characters are the smartest people in the room at all times. Mm-hmm. And of course, Zach has to show up the teacher at the end. And he's a little bit like Aaron Sorkin in his writing in that way where, you know, his characters have to mop the floor with everyone else. But
yeah, that's a good comparison. Very Aaron Sorkin-esque. Yeah.
But yeah, I appreciate it. Again, the unsubtlety of it. But I loved what you said there, Jesse, about, you know, asking where you were when this happened. And my 40th birthday is coming up. There's been a few events over my life where that has now happened. And in the last couple of years, I'm sure there's going to be a lot more, apparently. So that's an interesting take on that. Yeah.
Yeah. It just, I don't know, worries me about the future. Is there going to be another event where it's like, where were you on that day? You know?
Oh, boy. It's like, yeah, there's always going to be. That's humanity, right? You know, there's always going to be something. Hopefully, not all bad, but yeah, that's going to be a thing. I mean, people are going to ask, like, what did you do during the COVID-19 pandemic? Like, I'm sure that's going to be a question that, you know, yeah. Teachers will say 30, 40 years from now, I was like, ask your grandparents where they were. So that's the thing.
Yep. And you'll explain, oh, one day we used to wear masks everywhere we went. You know, it's so weird. But I'm waiting for the next where were you day. And it's where were you when the 14th Star Trek movie came out? That's the next one I want.
I don't know. You mean the 15th? Because Galaxy Quest, come on.
Oh, okay.
That won't be for another 20 decades from now, so. Mm-hmm. 20 yes. decades. I meant 20 years, but 20 decades. It still sounds about right. It's
a long
somewhere.
Time.
They'll film it on a holodeck. It'll be great.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the last story is Requital, and that's by Michael A. Martin and Andy Mangels. And this takes place during the events of the DS9 finale, What You Leave Behind, and involves a character named Reese. And I have to say, this does feel like a good story to end the book with of all these stories, because it is going towards the end of the war, and it's during the last episode of Deep Space Nine. And Dan, being the huge Deep Space Nine fan you are, I'm just curious what you thought of this one.
I was really fascinated by this story. I love any time an author can take a small character and flesh them out and give them something interesting. And Reese, of course, being, I think, pretty much the only like named survivor we get at the end of the Siege of AR-558 outside of our Deep Space Nine crew. You know, always an interesting story. He carried that knife with him and then dropped it in the soil as he left and had the Jem'Hadar feeding tubes as trophies. He was quiet. We never learned a lot about him. And I think, you know, he was used to really good effect in this story. it almost felt like when I was reading it, the author almost wanted to use the other character, one of the other characters who sadly passed away in that episode, but kind of had this guy and maybe put some characteristics of other characters on this character. But again, he's kind of a blank slate, so I think it works. And then the other one that surprised me was the Cardassian officer was also somebody we saw in the final episode of Deep Space Nine, just had like a couple lines kind of thing. So I really enjoyed that and how closely it tied to what was going on in that story. So on a number of levels, I enjoyed the story and was appropriately traumatized by what some of the characters go through in it too, I think.
Yeah, I thought it like really worked again, especially as a final story, because it was a really story about like what happens after war. And we got to see a little bit of that in the show proper, but not a lot. And while this story takes place during that episode, I think it almost in a weird way kind of better grapples with some of those like traumas that are left after a war than Deep Space Nine did, because a lot of it was just sort of like everyone saying goodbye. It was very bittersweet, and then you know Sisko going to fight evil Gul Dukat. So it was like still had a lot of the action, whereas this one's a much more of a quieter thing, where it's like Rees trying to kill the Founder because there's a lot of like trauma and resentment and anger that still exists, even though you know the peace or war has been ended, I should say. And it's a difficult thing to really grapple with, but it's just like, oh yeah, the war's over, but like there's still a lot of scars that need to, or a lot of wounds that need to heal over and will become scars and will never fully heal. And I think that it's an interesting sort of look at that in a way that I think you know, not that it's a bad thing that Deep Space Nine didn't necessarily deal with that in and of itself, but it's something that it could have and it didn't, and I think the story does that really well.
I mean, I think it's an important note to leave this collection of war stories on too, you know.
Yeah,
that kind of drives it home a bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I was just thinking there was a novelization of What You Leave Behind. I have never read the novelization, but I'd love to see this story worked into that novelization, so when you read it includes this, you know, because that's what I love about some of the novelizations out there that really expand and give you extra scenes and extra character development and things that you didn't see in the movie. And this would play so well into that. So that would be really cool, in my opinion. But the changeling, she freaks me out even on the page. I could just hear her voice and just like, even she's just like, oh, like, I don't care if I'm killed, you know, I pay the price or whatever. It's like for all the things that she's done. But, you know, yeah, it was a good ending.
It just showcases like her character just had no remorse. Like the only reason she gives up at the end is because she's kind of backed into a corner because she personally would die otherwise. And she was willing to just let everyone die around her if Odo hadn't offered her that chance to survive at the end there. So yeah, it just speaks to like, she didn't stop the war because she believed in peace and wanting to end it. She was ready to like salt the earth. So it just makes her even more terrifying at the end here. Like, cause it's like, she deserves to go through a trial and be held up for crimes or whatever that determines to be is the case. But it's also sort of like, yeah, you understand a lot why Rees would be, wanting to say like she deserves to die because she's a terrible, terrible person. And again, not to say that it's a right choice and that she should be, you know, held accountable via a trial, but you understand the emotion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, that's it. I mean, those are all the stories. And then the book ends with the Dominion War timeline that Keith DeCandido put together. And I didn't go through and read it, you know, word for word. I just kind of skimmed through and picked certain parts of it. But the thing I like about it, it doesn't just acknowledge the timeline of what happens in this book or in the DS9 episodes, but what has taken place in other books, such as The Lives of Dax and Prophecy and Change and the comics and so on and so forth, even the Strange New Worlds anthology stories. And it gives you a timeline that combines all those into the back of this book so you can get a full aspect of what was going on during the Dominion War. I don't know if either one of you read through those or not.
I didn't. I just sort of glanced at it. I didn't read the whole thing. Though, funny you should mention, just random aside, just because you made me think of it, the Lives of Dax book was my first Star Trek novel that I ever bought.
Oh.
Randomly. Anyways, just as an aside.
Very cool. Put that on the list.
I know.
That's another one that I have not read. It was the first book I got because it was in a dollar. Sorry, this is an aside. This is a random thing. But like, I was in a dollar store. It was a Dollar General. And it was in those, like, you know, those like crappy, like little book sections that they have in Dollar Generals. And I was like, oh, it's a Star Trek thing. I don't recognize these characters because I hadn't seen Deep Space Nine at the time, but I want it. So yeah, that was my first book I've ever owned and never read. So I still
wow.
have it.
Oh, that's awesome. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. I have that one. And I think I only read the first story, and I always think about, I need to read it. And
oh,
it's
wow.
sitting on my shelf. Yeah.
Hmm, interesting.
But you've read it, Dan?
A long time ago when it first came out, so it's been a long time, but yeah.
It's been a long road.
Getting from there to here.
Definitely. So, Jesse, what are your final thoughts on Tales of the Dominion War?
I thought this was really, really great. I mean, there's a couple of stories here and there that I wasn't so fond of, but on the whole, I thought this was just a really, really great collection. Not only because it gives you a peek at like all of the different places that a lot of our different characters throughout all of Star Trek were during the Dominion War, like Picard and a couple of the characters in the books, but it also, I think thematically, I think it just interestingly like weaves together just a really good portrait of what war is like, a sort of like tales of glory that you get from Klingons, the sort of like looking back and retrospectives on it, the trauma that comes after the war, these people who like feed on war and like are warmongers, the pain that comes from being within it, people who aren't soldiers but have to live during a war. Like, I think there's just like this book just really gives a full fleshed out feeling of what war can really be like during in a civilization like this and the just totality of it. So I think like it's a fun Star Trek book, and yet also I think just it pays homage in the best way to what Deep Space Nine was trying to do with its with the Dominion War in general. So I think for that, I think it's a really great collection.
Awesome. That sounds great. Dan?
Yeah, I'm going to agree 100% with all of that. And it's funny how long it took me to read this book and had never read it up to this point. And in retrospect, I feel like part of that might be some subconscious idea that I'm not a fan of war, obviously. I don't like things that glorify war. And I feel like maybe mm-hmm. this cover at some point said to me, like, ooh, the glories of war, the, you know, raising the flag and all that stuff, which
it is sort of referencing like Iwo Jima.
Yeah, exactly.
From World War
II. Yeah. Which, you know, is kind of a bit of a silly fear on my part because I know Star Trek and even more importantly, I know Star Trek as written by all of these authors. So, you know, that fear is completely unfounded. There's stories that run the gamut as far as war goes in here. There are the things that, you know, say the righteousness of soldiers marching off to honorable battle and all this stuff, but it's countered with the real trauma and the real scars that war produces. And I feel like it's a very well-rounded representation of, Jesse, you put it perfectly, what war means to a civilization like the Federation or the other civilizations that got drawn in over the course of the war. So yeah, I highly recommend this collection. I found something to enjoy in every story, even the couple that weren't my favorite, you know? So every story I think is worth a look, and there are some real gems in here that are some of the best Star Trek prose I've read. So in my opinion, very highly recommended for this one.
And also one other thing we didn't touch upon too, I mentioned it earlier, but there's that Loxana Troi story that we didn't talk too much about that I also think is just a great look at like civilians, how civilians sort of like have to deal with this sort of thing. And she becomes like a sort of like a resistance leader on Beta Zed in that story, which I think is cool. And also I didn't even think about this, like Mr. Hood dies. Or Mr. Her like
oh Mr. Hom, yeah.
Hom, Mr. Hom, excuse me. He dies in this and kind of explains where he was. Like, yeah, it's like, wow, that's dark and it's rough.
So, I've forgotten about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he even speaks and they're like, oh, I didn't know he talks.
Yeah. No, it's a very bittersweet end. But I mean, yeah, it showcases like real loss, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
No, that was a really good story. I mean, there's a lot of good ones in here. And even the ones that we were saying are least favorite are still good ones. You know, they're all good. There's just some that, you know, we like better than others. And I don't really have much more to say than what the two of you have said about it. It's to me, if you are into Deep Space Nine, then you would want to read this book, even though it's not all DS9, but it's the Dominion War, which of course is a big piece of DS9, and it gives you what's going on throughout the Star Trek universe. And as we were talking through this here at the end, when I was listening to the two of you, I'm going to make a plea to Simon and Schuster to do something similar during the Klingon War from Star Trek Discovery, because you're not going to step on any toes because they've moved on to the 32nd century. So let's see what other starships were doing during that time. I mean, we had John Jackson Miller do what the Enterprise was during that time, but I'd like to see
others.
Pike
was, I forgot that we had that book too. Yeah, it would be interesting.
And
it would be
really cool with regards to that too, is you've also got a nice built-in chunk there where Discovery was gone for 6 months of that war, right? They jumped ahead and we've got that nice 6 month period to play with in which the Federation was brought to the brink, right? So
yes, that's when it needs to take place. Yes, in that 6 months that we didn't see. I love it. Yes, that's what we need. So Simon Schuster, get on it. And Dan and Jesse will write one of the stories for you.
I'd be happy to.
I mean I would too, but don't expect much.
Well, I'll do a quick rating and then I want to hear what yours are. So I'm going to give this 4 out of the 5 doctors in one story. So Dan, what do you say?
Oh man, that's a good rating. I'm going to give it, I'm going to say 4.5 out of 5 grumpy dock workers that don't want to fix Federation starships.
Nice, Jesse.
I'll give the same as you, Dan, 4.5 grappling hooks that try to like grapple onto the Excalibur out of 5. So yeah, 4 and 4.5. Four hit and then one glances off, but it gets close.
I was going to say 4.5, but I didn't want to chop a doctor in half. So I just went 4. But I guess if you're going to chop 1.5, it should be the EMH, right?
I was going to say, he glitches, so it's only his legs appear.
There you go.
Right.
Yeah. You'd hear him complain about that. Or just his top half. It's like, only my top half. What's going on here? Complaining and whining. You know he would.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, Jesse, when you're not here on Positively Trek doing a book review, where can people find you?
You can find me on YouTube at Jesse Gender. Like I said before, that's where I do sort of my big video essay type stuff. I have videos coming out at least every other week or so, sometimes more. I've been doing interviews with like Star Trek folks as well. If you're into Star Trek, I interviewed Jack Quaid from Lower Decks. Recently, I think either by the time that this comes out or very soon, I interviewed Bill Wolkoff, who is a producer on Strange New Worlds, as well as Kipo and the Age of the Wonder Beast, and a bunch of other folks. So check out that because there's a bunch of Star Trek stuff. I have a secondary channel called Jesse Gender After Dark, where I do news, reviews, reactions. I'm reviewing Star Trek Lower Decks over there. I have another podcast that I do called Jumpgate, where I sort of review every episode of Babylon 5 that I'm rewatching myself, and then my co-host Vera Wild of Council of Geeks is watching for the first time. And that's pretty much everything I do. And since this is me wrapping up, I'm going to say this right here. Bruce, I'm going to miss you on this podcast. I know you recently announced on the last episode that you're going to be leaving the show, and it is very sad to hear that because this is my favorite Star Trek podcast that I listen to, and I'm sure it will still remain that way with Dan on here and whoever comes on as well to help co-host the show. But you will most sorely be missed, Bruce. So thank you for all the entertainment you have given me on this show for many months and years now. So yeah, I just wanted to say that. I'm going to miss you. You do really good work. So I wish you all the best in all your endeavors. And I'm sure I'll see you around. It's not going to be the last time we see or talk to each other.
Of course.
But I will miss you week to week. So.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Even talking during this, I was like, I don't know, maybe I should stay. Like, I'm enjoying this. But who knows what will happen. But yeah, I'm definitely going to be leaving. But who knows, I may return at some point to do something. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how it all plays out. But, you know, Jesse, it was you that convinced me to leave. So any listeners... No, I'm kidding.
Oh, wow. Send the hate mail my way.
No. Jesse didn't have anything to do with it. So yes, I appreciate that. So... yeah. Dan, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Kertrats. That's K-E-R-T-R-A-T-S. YouTube.com/Kertrats Productions. And of course, in the Positively Trek discussion group on Facebook, which is, I say this all the time, my absolute favorite place to hang out online, because y'all are really nice in there. And that's awesome. It's rare to find that online sometimes these days. So thank you all who are part of that.
Yes, and you can find me on Twitter at @Admiral_Rex. That's Admiral with the underline Rex. And you will not find me on Positively Trek much anymore. So there you go. No, but also follow us on Twitter at Positively Trek. Also on Instagram at Positively Trek. Send an email to PositivelyTrek@gmail.com. Look for our Goodreads group to see upcoming books. Oh my gosh, we need to update that. I don't even know what books are coming up. That we need to figure out. Even though I'm leaving, we need to figure that out. So Lives of Dax may be on there. I don't know.
Well, I'm excited for the Strange New Worlds book coming soon. Yeah. That I'm very, very pumped about.
Yes, yes. You were on the panel where that got announced.
I know. I was very pumped. You had me guess, by the way. You was like, what do you think it's going to be? And I didn't know until that moment. I was very excited. So
that was a fun panel. Oh, and Jesse, by the way, if you really miss me that much, just go back and listen to the old episodes.
I've listened to every single one. I've not missed a single episode of this show.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yeah, and I listened to a good chunk of Literary Trek before that, too. So.
Oh, bless so you, my that child. Person.
She's yes, I am that. I told you, this is my favorite podcast. There's a reason I literally listen to every single one of your episodes.
So. You're the one person that listened to every one. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, thanks everyone for listening. And yeah, we'll be around next time. So go out into the world and stay positive.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.